blessing. So if we could give a warm Valley Group welcome to Lorraine MacD of Paradise, that would be fantastic.
Thank you. Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Justin. Thank you. Thank you, Tammy, for getting a hold of me before. And thank you, Bill, for being a friend. So, can you hear me? Can everyone hear me okay? Good. Okay. Let's see. I found out how long I can talk because, and that's good for you, because I get really excited about it. When I talk about sobriety and God and all that's happened, I can just get wound up, you know, and 3 hours later I go, oh my, you know. So anyway, but I won't do that because I was told when to stop. So, And I was also, as you heard, I've got 40 years sobriety, so I came in a long time ago when we were told certain things by the old timers, and one of them was, you know, share my experience, strength, and hope. And I still do that all the time. I try to always give a little bit of what it was like, because sometimes I'll go to a meeting and people will say, well, we all drank, I'm not going to talk about it. And I think, well, I'd like to hear that, because, you know, the newcomers, they need to be able to relate a little bit, because, you know, I mean, we drive up in these nice cars and we look halfway clean, we got clothing on our body, and, you know, and it's hard for newcomers sometimes to relate to that. So I do like to give a little bit of what it was like. So we'll get on with it. And yes, I was born in Detroit, Michigan, and I was a weird child. I was, I was skinnier than the other girls. I felt like I didn't fit. I was furry all over, and I had dark hair, and I was dark, and I came from a family of blonde, blue-eyed, and I didn't know where I came from. I didn't fit in, but I was raised in the church, and the church did not damage me. I was raised in the Catholic Church, and that's what saved my life, because I didn't have any friends at school. Like I said, I didn't fit in. I didn't know how to talk to people and stuff. But when I went to church, I had a lot of friends that, you know, they were all invisible and they were saints, but I was accepted. You know, that's where I fit. And, so I was very happy there, and something happened when I was a kid, but you know, no matter if anything had happened or not, I was destined to take a drink. I know that because I was an alcoholic waiting, because my older brother, he was 3 years older than me, and so I was 11 years and 9 months when his girlfriend, so he was 3 years older than me, and he had an older girlfriend, so she was an older woman. She was like 16, and she sat me down one night just before my 12th birthday, and she told me the facts of life, and she gave me a cigarette, and she put a bottle of booze on the table. And those three things stayed together for the next 21 years. I mean, she taught me how to drink, she told me about the birds and the bees, and all I could think about was that drink. She told me all this fascinating, interesting stuff, but all I focused on was that drink. And what I remember from that drink is I didn't feel tall. I didn't feel like I'd put on weight. I didn't feel like my unibrow vanished or the fur fell off of my arms. I didn't feel any of that. What I did feel was I didn't care. I didn't care that I was no longer like everybody else or that I didn't fit in. And all I wanted to do was get more of that. You know, and it was really hard because I was not even 12 years old and there was no booze in my house. My parents had never drank. I did not see my parents drink. And for years I thought my parents never drank. I found out later that my parents met in a bar. They were, well, we're not supposed to say anyone's an alcoholic, but they sure had some symptoms. And what they did when Mom got pregnant, she told my dad he could never drink again or smoke those funny little cigarettes that he was smoking, and he just stopped. And both of them stopped drinking and doing any other substances when she got pregnant. And for 55 years, they were raging, angry, white-knuckling alcoholics. And that's the house I was raised in. And so it was hard for me to find anything to drink. But fortunately, I was in Detroit. And so I was able to find some guys. You know, I was able to start cutting school, which I did immediately. I got alcoholic behavior immediately. I started cutting school, trying to find the guys that had the bottles and trading whatever I had to trade. And you know, when you're 12 years old, there's not a lot to trade. And so I was busy trading myself for a drink. And, you know, and I was starting to cut school all the time. My parents were getting irritated. But yet my parents, because I just told you they were alcoholic who never drank, and so they never talked to me about my drinking. They never tried to control me. Instead, what they did was they just brought me in the house, kept it secret. You don't let the neighbors know. I was raised in a house of secrets, but it's got to always look good. And so my dad, I remember one day, three guys pulled up in front of his house, and he was watering his lawn, and they tossed me out on his front lawn drunk. I was 13 years old at that time, and they just tossed me out. My dad came out, picked me up, took me and put me in the bed. And the next morning, I got up, and they never said a word about my drinking. But that's how it happened. That's where I was at that age, you know. And so my parents, when we were 13, my older brother was getting in trouble too. He was drinking all the time. And so my parents, rather than talk to us about it, they put the house up for sale and took a Geographic, and they moved to San Jose, California. And that was supposed to fix us. And all that did was it allowed me a lot more guys, you know, a whole new batch, and they were all blonde. The ocean was closer, you know, life was good. And I just took off just like I was, only now I was older. And so I was no longer looking for the, you know, the bad boys in high school. Now I was going for the dropouts. And you would find me at the age of 13 years old, I was hanging around in drugstores, and in the drugstores that had, you know, all the motorcycles out front at the curb, and in the back of the drugstores they had pinball machines. Yes, I am aging myself. I'm 73 years old, and I was like, that's when I was, you know, 13, 14 years old. And I was in the back with all these bikers and trading what I had to trade to get drunk. You know, it's what I had to do, because that's all I wanted to do. You know, I was so uncomfortable. I told you, even as a little girl, a very little girl, I didn't feel I fit in anywhere except in church without a drink. I didn't know how to talk to people. I didn't know how to be around people. And so that's how I was living. And my parents were starting to really get on our backs, because, you know, here they had moved all the way from Detroit and the same behavior is happening. And so I met a guy, and his parents were starting to get on him a little bit too. By this time I'm 15 years old. My drinking has just, it's escalated. I've dropped out of school. Nothing is happening except me staying drunk, sneaking in the house at night, and then sneaking out before they could say anything. By then they're starting to talk. And so I met this guy. He was 17, and we decided that we were tired of our parents and we would just get married. So he was husband number one. I do number my husbands, you know, so I can keep track of them. He was husband number one. We got married in a big church wedding. I look at the pictures now, and it's adorable. I mean, we look like Ken and Barbie, you know, walking down the aisle, you know, 15 and 17 years old. And life was going to be good, because now we wouldn't have our parents bothering us. Well, the marriage was not good. Clearly, it was not good. It was based on our alcoholism. And so we had to do something to make the marriage a little better. So in our keen alcoholic thinking, we decided to have a baby. So we had baby number one, first baby. And things started getting even worse. I mean, violence started entering into the marriage. And he was drunk all the time. I was drunk all the time. And then it was Haight-Ashbury, the 60s. And we were in San Jose, and he would take off and go up to San Francisco, and he would come back, and he'd be painted all these different colors, and he was, it was just I didn't understand what was going on, and I had to go to a doctor and get tranquilizers because, actually it wasn't tranquilizers, it was Valium because I was a nervous wreck. And, the doctor never told me don't drink when you take these because I was far too young to drink. So, you know, I'm taking them and drinking, and he's up in San Francisco getting loaded and coming back and bringing his girlfriends and his weirdos and beating me up. And so we decided, you know, that marriage was really getting very bad. So I decided we'll have another baby and it'll make it good. So we have baby number two, a little boy. So now I got two little boys, and the marriage got so bad, that the violence got so bad, I had to divorce him. And he was the only divorce I had out of my marriages. But anyway, so I left him, and I was out in the streets, and I did not know how to live. Now I got two babies, I'm 17 years old, I don't have a clue how to live. So I found a man to marry me, to take care of me, and I knew better than to get married to somebody 17, young, good-looking, and poor. So I made sure I married somebody older than my father, who was very rich, and he gave me a Cadillac, and he built me a home up in the hills of San Jose, and everything that I could possibly want to not drink, to be happy. He owned his own business. He owned a fence company. And what happened was I kept drinking, and I couldn't stop. And he was a gambler. And so we had a baby girl to try to make that marriage good. I used marriage to make me better and babies to make the marriages better. And so we had a baby girl, the marriage got even worse. And so he, like I said, he was a gambler, and he went to Reno one weekend as always. And he came home unexpectedly, and he caught me rolling around on the family room floor drunk with his foreman. And he kicked me out, and he kept the foreman. He kept the foreman for years afterwards. He said, you know, he could always find a drunken broad, but good foremen are hard to find. So here I am out in the street. I got three babies. I'm not even old enough to legally drink. And I don't know how to take care of these kids. So I went back to my mother's house and my parents' house, and they did not want to take me in, but they were kind of put in a position where I had nowhere to go, so they let me in. And I went and got a job. I got my first job, and it was at a beer bar. And I really, really, truly, which God understands, I wanted to be a good mother. Now, most of what I'm going to tell you tonight, when I tell you what I think, what I was thinking then, or if I tell you what I was feeling then, I don't know that it's true. I may be lying. I don't know. Because I don't know what I thought. And I don't know what I felt. I was drunk all the time. And I know that if I did get a thought or a feeling, especially a feeling, I had to drink. And so when I tell you what I thought or I felt, what I'm truly doing is telling you what I think I might have thought, you know. So I wanted to be a good mother. I did. And so, you know, I'd go to work, and then I'd come home, and I'd read stories to the kids, and I'd make dinner, and I tried really hard to be a good mother. And that lasted about 2 weeks. And then I started staying after work and going home with the owner of the bar and going home with the customers and then going across the street to the hard liquor bar. I'm still not old enough to drink, but you know that's never stopped any of us. And I'm staying drunk all the time, and my kids are being hauled off to babysitters, and I got three of them there. And so I just stopped eating, and I just started drinking all the time. I woke up in the hospital, and the doctor told me if I continued to drink, I would die. All I was doing was drinking. So I went back to my parents and recuperated, and then had to get out, get a job, get another job, and I went to work at another beer bar. And like one of my first nights there, I'm crying in my beer about how I can't drink anymore to a customer. I'd never laid eyes on this man in my life. And I'm telling him how the doctor said I would die if I drank anymore. So he said, don't worry about it. I got something you can do, and you don't have to drink. And I walked off my job that night, and I left with a strange man and got in the car with him and drove up to San Francisco to a gas station, to a men's room at a gas station. And that man that I drove up there with turned out to be husband number three, the man, one of the men that I met in that gas station bathroom turned out to be husband number four. Later on, I kept him in mind. I always thought he worked at the gas station. He had a job. Maybe it'd be nice to have one with a job. So anyway, I went up there and I was introduced to the world of hard drugs. And I took my hard drugs. I took my street drugs alcoholically, you know. And so what that did was it put me in a circle that I just spun out of control. A lot of crime entered into it, and you know, I got my kids back. I with that man, we tried to put together a home. That was husband number three. We tried to have an apartment, and he tried to work, and I tried to raise the kids, and I was doing both now. I was, you know, staying up constantly and crashing constantly and drinking the whole time, and so was he. And at 10 o'clock one night, we decided that our problem was San Jose. We needed to go leave the state. So at 10 o'clock at night, we made the sound decision to put a trailer on the back of my little T-Bird, and we took off for Oklahoma City. And we were almost to Oklahoma City when we ran out of money, and we realized we don't know a soul in Oklahoma City. We don't know where we're going, what we're going to do, but that was one of those alcoholic keen ideas. But fortunately, he was a career man, so it took him no time to get a job, and as he was climbing through the skylight of the bar that he was robbing, he fell through and he broke his leg. And so he ended up in McAllister State Prison for a year. And I was there with three children and not knowing how to survive. But I got a job at the Clown Lounge. So you know right away it was another bar. And I was at the Clown Lounge one night, and husband number two walked in with a gun, pointed it at me and told me to give him his daughter. And He got his daughter and took her back to California, told the judge that he had found her to babysitters, and he was given custody of her, and I did not lay eyes on her again for over 10 years. And I stayed there, and I struggled trying to stay drunk, the feelings, the thoughts, every time something would come up, I had to have a drink because I was not this person. This is not the person that I had wanted to be. This was my alcoholism out of control. And finally, after a year, I came back to California only because my father flew me back because I was in serious trouble. The kids, I had been farming them out at the church and picking them up back home. It was horrible. My dad brought me back to California, and but they said I couldn't stay there with them. So now I got two boys. So I went on a hunt, and I found that man I'd met in that gas station, and we got married. So he's husband number four. And I did not divorce husband number two or three. You know, I didn't have time for that. So anyway, so we got married, and we were married for 7 years, and there was a lot of crime in that, and we tried really hard. He would get a job. He'd done a lot of time in prison, and he'd been trained in different careers while at prison, and he'd get a job, and I would stay home. He'd get an apartment, and I'd have the two boys, and you know, we'd buy pots and pans, and I would try really, really, really hard to be a mother, to raise my kids while he went to work, and he'd get maybe two weeks under his belt, and I'd get 2 weeks of putting this little apartment together, and he'd pick up a six-pack of beer and bring it home because you had to celebrate. We were doing this successfully. We were making it, you know, and we'd each have a couple of beers, and next thing you know, after we had those beers, we were off and running again. We'd be selling the refrigerator out of a furnished apartment because we were into that crime and just, you know, and I kept getting arrested, and the kids kept getting taken from me and getting back, finally the court took my boys from me and said that I would never lay eyes on my sons as long as I lived, and shipped them off to their father, and he lived in Cheyenne, Wyoming, and when they got there, they were told that I was dead. And that husband and I, we'd had a baby girl in bed. He delivered her in our bed because our marriage was bad, and I had lost a baby girl, and in our keen alcoholic thinking, we made a decision to get pregnant and have another baby. And then I couldn't quit using or drinking, and we had that baby in bed. And when when she was born, my husband stayed with her at the hospital. She was in the hospital for 6 weeks, and he stayed at the hospital every single day with her and let her hold his finger while he'd visit with her until she got out. And then he took her to his sister, and he told me he did not want me raising her. Neither father that took my daughter wanted them to grow up to be like me, so they wanted to protect them from me. So anyway, I continued living the life of crime to get whatever I needed, and I ended up in CIW, and they were announcing AA, you know, AA in the cafeteria. And so one of the girls, for some reason, said, you know, I think you need to go to that, Lorraine. I didn't think I needed to go because things were going well at that time. I mean, I had my own cell. Everything was going right. You know, I didn't have any problems. But then they said, well, you know, they bring in men and cigarettes and donuts and coffee. So I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, my first meeting, to smoke, eat, drink, and look. And that's the only reason I came into AA. And, you know, I would go. And then I was sent over to CRC, and so I was there for 13 months, and I'd go to the meetings, and they would come in every Sunday. They'd bring them in, and I'd attend every Sunday, and I'd listen to them and smoke their cigarettes. And at no time did I ever think that Alcoholics Anonymous had anything to offer me, because I just thought I was different. You know, I thought, the things I had done, the places I had done, and they looked all together. They looked like normal people, you know. But I attended the meetings, and then when I left, when I paroled, I swore I wasn't going to do anything. I was not ever going to go back there. I had made up my mind I would never go back there. So when I got out, 30 days later, I'm doing exactly the same behavior as before I was arrested. Nothing had changed, you know, so they arrested me again, and I got new cases, and I was sent back, and I was sent back for another year. And those people were still coming in on Sundays to do the meeting, which impressed me, number one, because they would come in on Easter, Super Bowl Sunday. You know, they didn't care. They were there. And that impressed me. And only now I'm starting to listen. I'm going to the meetings and I'm listening and I'm thinking, maybe they have something that can help, you know. And so after the meetings, I would go back to my room and I would write my husband, who was at that time in San Quentin. And by the way, he and I were married 7 years. It was the longest marriage ever because, you know, every time he'd go to Folsom, I'd go to county jail or CIW or CRC, you know, and he'd go to San Quentin, and so we took state vacations, and so our marriage lasted a long time. So I would go back to my cell, and I would write him, and I would say, you need to go to AA meetings. I know they have them there, and you're an alcoholic. And I knew that if he went to AA, that our marriage would be good. And so then I paroled, and I didn't think it would work for me, but I picked up enough information in those meetings to know not to get out and go back to the same lifestyle, that it wasn't going to work. So they put me in a halfway house in Oakland, and the nice thing about halfway houses is they're always within a block or two of a liquor store. And so after they gave me all the rules and regulations, I just left, and I went down to get one beer. Because I had picked up on the fact that I couldn't drink or do anything else. So I figured, okay, I'll just have one beer only. So I took off for the liquor store, and I bought a six-pack, and that was it. I can't tell you where I went. I can't tell you who I was with, what I did, or how long it was. I went into a full-blown blackout, and I can't put it together. I have no paperwork. I've never been able to find anything to show me what happened in my life. But eventually, I called my husband and told him that I was home, and he was in Santa Rosa. He had paroled in June. This was in August. And I told him to come and get me. And I told him that, you know, where I had some idea of where I'd been, and I knew where to go and party. Let's call it party. That was no party. That was hell. But anyway, And he told me, he said, Lorraine, I can't live that way anymore. He had been going to those AA meetings in San Quentin. And he said, I can't live that way anymore. I want to get the kids back. I want to have jobs. I can't do it anymore. And I let him know exactly what I thought about all that, that he could do that, but I couldn't. And that I wanted to grab him by the hand, and he knew it, and drag him right back through the gates of hell. We were on our way back there, and so my husband took his only way out of this alcoholism. He took his life. And you would think that that would have been my bottom, but it wasn't my bottom. I ended up in a recovery program after spending time on Skid Row, sitting on a curb, drinking a bottle of Ripple. I was stealing my booze, you know, so price was no object. I could steal anything. But I stole Ripple because it got me there fastest. And the parole officer family put me in a recovery program. It was a 9 month, and when I had to leave, nothing had changed. I didn't change. Nothing changed about me. So I became an alcohol and drug counselor so I could stay. Then the program folded, and so I had to go in the streets, and I didn't know how to live. So I grabbed a counselor, had a year sobriety, and on his 1 year sobriety, we got married. He was husband number 5. We got married, and on his 1 year of sobriety, and my hiding my booze, I was hiding booze in the closet and in my trunk, taping pills to the bottom of my dresser. We got my two boys back. We got a job. We each got a car. We got a rental house. We got two dogs. We got neighbors. We got laundry. We got doctor's appointment. We got shopping, and that was my bottom. When I had to say good morning to the neighbors, when I had to call the teachers, when I had to make a doctor's appointment for my kids, that was my bottom. I did not know how to live in the world like the rest of you. And so I left the job, I left the kids, and I headed up back to Skid Row. I was on my way out. And what happened was I got stopped by God. I was only a block from that job, and a man I had met in a recovery program who was a 13-stepper stopped me. And he asked how I was doing, and I said that I was doing great. And so he took me home, and he kept me for 3 days. I thought, good, husband number 6. Well, it turned out he was detoxing me. And then he told me, Lorraine, I can't have anything to do with a woman who's not in AA. And being willing to go to any length to get a husband, I walked into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's how I got here. I came in for all the wrong reasons, and I came in behaving wrong. I came in not sitting in my seat. I came in looking for somebody to take care of me because I didn't think I was good enough to work the program or that you would let me stay if you really knew who I was. And so nobody kicked me out. Nobody told me that the whole time that I was introducing myself as I'm Lorraine, an alcoholic, I didn't even say my name. I said, I'm Lo, an alcoholic addict. You know, I had to keep separate from you because I knew I couldn't be a part of you. Nobody told me I couldn't talk like that. Nobody told me I couldn't use all my four-letter words that I was using. They let me stay looking for a husband and misbehaving. And because of that, I'm here today with 40 years sober because you didn't kick me out. You allowed me to come in the rooms and detox in the rooms. And what happened was I came in for all the wrong reasons, but I stayed for all the right ones. I didn't think I could fit in this program, but because you allowed me to stay in the rooms, and you didn't throw me out when I wasn't sitting still or when I wasn't dressed appropriately. You didn't throw me out. Because of that, I was able to start listening a little bit. But what happened for me was I stuck around for 6 years. For 6 years, I did not put anything in my body. And during that 6 years, I got my kids back. I got a job. I got a rental place. You know, things came together because I wasn't drinking. But nothing really changed within me because, once again, I didn't think I was good enough to work the program. And I finally, at 6 years sober, was going to leave. Now, I was doing H&I even. I was coordinator of a mental hospital. I was going out to the VA. I was doing everything. I was walking the walk and talking the talk. You would have thought I was a sober queen. But, you know, it was all fake, and I knew at 6 years I was going back out because I was a liar. And so I got a sponsor, and she worked the steps with me. And as soon as she worked the steps with me, my whole world changed. you know, and then went on to learn the traditions, do the traditions and the concepts. My entire world changed. You know, I became truly sober, and my whole goal was to stay sober and help others. And by then, I started doing service not for me, not so I'd look good and you'd like me and you'd invite me over, out to coffee and stuff. But I started doing service because it made me feel good to see somebody get the light in their eyes, to go into the jail and to hand the book to somebody who was only there because she had a drunk driving and it wasn't her fault, and to go back a few weeks later and to have her come up to the bars, tears in her eyes run down her cheeks saying, oh my God, I think I might be an alcoholic. You know, and that's all I wanted to do, not to look good anymore. And so anyway, as Jim said, I was very active in H&I. I got married. I married a man not to help me, not to save me, not to be my higher power. By then I was talking to my higher power again, because the whole time before when I was out there, I was never the one who was arrested and locked up in jail and dropped to my knees and prayed to God, please get me out of this. I'll never do it again. I swear, I never did that because I didn't want God to know where I was. You know, because I was raised in the church, I had a good, loving, kind God, and I didn't want to be a disappointment. So, you know, in sobriety, I was able to reconnect with my God, and life began to get really good. And my husband and I made the decision to leave Redwood City when I was 12 years sober and to move to Paradise. And we got a home in Paradise, and now my sons, my daughters, I got a little relationship with both daughters, but they didn't want to be too close to me. They never did trust me. So they both live in down south, Southern California. And my boys, they were practicing what their father and I had taught them how to do, you know, and they'd go in and out of AA and in and out of NA. And finally, we moved to Paradise. I'm very active in the program. I'm very active in H&I, and I'm going to the jail all the time, and I'm going to a mental hospital, and my son calls me, the son that I had left to take care of his little brother and sister in Oklahoma, because I would go to the Klan Lounge, and he was only 6 years old. His brother was 4 and his sister was 2, and I would leave him in charge of them because I had to go work. You know, and this was the boy who suddenly calls me and he says, Mom, I'm really sick and I don't know what, the doctors don't know what's wrong and I need help. And he's living down by Oakdale. My father calls me at the same time in Santa Clara. This is the man, him and my mother told the parole board they didn't want me to parole to Santa Clara County because they knew I'd rob their house, I'd rob people. You know, it didn't matter. They didn't want me in Santa Clara County. And now all of a sudden he's calling me, he's telling me, Lorraine, the doctors say I only have a few weeks and I want you to take care of me. Now, I'm living in Paradise. I got a son in Oakdale, almost 3 hours away. I got a dad in, you know, 2.5 hours away. I got a dad in Santa Clara, 2.5 hours away. And they both want me there. And you know, it ended up, I went to work for a guy in the program. Didn't even know it when I applied for the job in Paradise. And he said, take the time off and go and be with them and we'll cover you. And he would do my work while I went and took care of my dad and my son. And my sponsor left Paradise and she moved 11 miles away from my son in Oakdale. This is how God works, you know. I could never make amends to my sons for the things that I did, you know. And I was with my dad when he walked into the arms of God. My mother, she didn't want anything to do with me. And I prayed to God every day, let me be the daughter you want me to be, not the daughter my mother deserves. And I was able to take care of my mother and walk her into the arms of her God. And a few years ago, you know, my youngest son, he moved up to Paradise to be close to me, and I found him on his kitchen floor dead, and he was not able to get this program, and he was trying to go to NA, he was trying to go to AA, and he was trying to go to Bible study, but the damage had been done to his heart already, and so he never made it. And my oldest boy, he moved up to Paradise to be close to me, and we did find a doctor to help him. I fought. I was the girl that sat on the curb drinking Ripple, and through sobriety, I became the woman who could look in doctors' eyes and say, you will find what my son needs to save his life. So anyway, we're up there, and the fire hits, and my son's house burned down. They lost everything, and, you know, it was as you know, the whole community was gone. My fellowship was gone. All my sponsees scattered to the wind. It was pretty devastating, and we had to find a place to live. And we moved to Placerville because my son couldn't find a place to live because he's disabled, and he had two dogs, and they can't walk stairs, and they couldn't find a place to live. And so my husband said, let's move to Placerville, and we'll get a house, and we'll live with them, and as we grow old and die, they'll just have the house. They'll never be homeless again. And so that's what we did, and we moved here, and 5 days later, my husband died, and that was totally unexpected. And so now suddenly I'm in a strange town. All my sponsees, my fellowship, everything's gone. And you know, through that whole thing, it is so incredible because I just told you the kind of mother I was. You know, how can I possibly make amends for that? You know, I could tell my kids all day long I can say I was wrong for what I did. Whatever I can do to make it right, just tell me and I will do it. There is no way there was anything I could do to make it right. But what God did, because I stayed ready. I stayed ready for 38 years to make amends to my son. I always told God every morning, God, if there is anything I can do to help you, my fellows, my family, please show me. And I was ready to make amends. And what he did was he put me in this house where I get to make amends to my son. Today, I get to cook the meals for my son and his wife that I couldn't cook for him when he was a little boy because I was drunk. I have fully made amends to my son because God put that together and not me. You know, I have not fully connected to any fellowship here because, you know, shortly after I moved here, COVID came in, and we are of the high risk, and so we stay in, and we're on Zoom only. But isn't that another blessing, you know, that God has given us, is we have Zoom and we can stay connected. You know, it's like I was at a meeting the other day, and one of my friends said that her sponsor, or that her therapist told her, we're working on getting you to acceptance. And when she reaches acceptance, then we're going to strive to get you to acceptance with joy. And I've been thinking about that a lot because I do accept these things that happen in sobriety, and I don't have to understand them, but I do accept them. And because I ask God every day, God, just show me where some good can come out of this, and good always does. And I was looking at it, and it's like acceptance with joy. I am so grateful for so much. Yes, there was pain moving here and having my husband unexpectedly die and not knowing anybody here, not knowing anybody. And my sponsees and my friends scattered across the United States. You know, how can joy come out of that? It's because we're reconnected on Zoom, and all those gifts we were given in our strong fellowship that we had in paradise, we can do it out there now. And I'm going to end with one last thing. When I found my son, and he was on the floor, dead, I immediately, my first thought was, God, how could you have given me this and not my son? And my next thought was, no, God gave me my son. I had him there for 7 years. God gave me my son, and I did not deserve to have that boy. And I remember, I was general chair of H&I for a while, and as general chair, you get to go into the prisons and chair like these little mini conferences that they have in there. And I remember one time I was in San Quentin, and I was cheering to the men, and all of a sudden I looked out and I realized with this realization that my husband had attended those very meetings in that room and touched those walls. And my husband's solution to his alcoholism was to take his life. And my brother had attended meetings in that room. And my brother had gotten out, and he was living in the streets of Chico, still drinking and legally blind. He didn't get AA either. And my baby boy that had died, he had attended those meetings in that room, and he didn't get it either. And you know, when I asked God, I said, you know, why me? These were three men that were really better people than me. I was not a good person out there at all, as you now know. and why me and not them? And, you know, the heavens didn't open, and there wasn't a booming voice with this great answer, but there was a calmness that came over that let me know that I was to keep doing what I was doing. I need to continue walking forth and carrying this message of AA and carrying the message of hope and saying, you know, we have hope. All we have to do is what that book says and carry the message to the next alcoholic. And I want to thank you again for allowing me to share, for being here. And